Hello there, everyone, and a warm welcome back to the Final Draft podcast. As always, with me, Adam Bastin, and my co-host, Alex Knox. It's an absolute pleasure for us to introduce you to and welcome the brilliant writer and director, Mark Jenkin, mastermind behind the BAFTA award-winning film, Bait. This is our first interview together, discussing our passion for storytelling, Mark's fascinating style of filmmaking, and a great insight into his upcoming feature, Ainsman. Now, our discussion did take place over Zoom, and although that we've done some wizardry backstage to make it sound the best it can be, please do keep this in mind. But that's enough from me. Thank you so much for tuning in as we welcome the fantastic Mark Jenkin.
Hello.
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 There we go.
I think I was probably getting my sound through a Bluetooth speaker that's downstairs.
Oh, we've been talking through your house.
Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Amazing. How you doing?
How's it going? Yeah, all right. How are you?
Yeah, not
good.
Bad.
Yeah, we're
doing
good.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you so much for coming on and giving us the time to talk to you about what you do and all the great things you do. It's a pleasure to have you on as like our first guest amongst all the other recordings that we've done. Thank you very much for coming on.
Pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
You're welcome.
Can I ask where you're calling from today?
I'm in a small village called Paul in the far west of Cornwall.
I see. The
west Amazing. Of Penzance.
West of Penzance. Okay.
Yeah, where are you guys?
I'm in the lovely town of Weston-super-Mare right now.
Oh yeah.
And Adam's up in Bristol.
I am indeed.
Well, yeah, thank you again for joining us. We do really appreciate it, and this is very exciting for us. Obviously we're going to ask you about Bait and upcoming films and you in general and films and all that good stuff, but to start with, I'm curious as to how you kind of got into this world and what was your introduction to film. Was it something from an early age that you knew you wanted to do, or did it just sort of come to you?
I think looking back now, I probably was pretty keen on getting into film. I always liked creating things. I spent quite a lot of my youth building model railways, or trying to. Pretty bad at it because I'm quite a shoddiest when it comes to detail. That's a term that Andrew Cotting uses, that he gave to me as well, describing me as a fellow shoddiest. when you're building model railways, you can't really have shoddy impressionistic model railways, I don't think. Maybe that is the new form, but you have to be you have to get the detail right. And so I was crap at making model railways, but I spent all my time thinking about doing that and trying to do that. And I spent the small amounts of money I had as a kid, I would spend on my model railway. I didn't expect to be talking about model railways this evening, but
neither. No, glad this is
you
great.
Are. Yeah.
but then that just became something else later in life. You know, creating worlds and having and playing God.
Of course.
Became, there are better ways of doing that. And it was film. But I got into film through photography. I was doing a biology A-level at St Austell College down here when I was sort of 16. And I didn't like doing a biology A-level. So I used to go and hide in the photographic darkroom where a mate of mine was printing his photos, and it was a really good place to hide because, you know, I don't know if you've been in a dark room, but it's you never really know who's in there. You get a sense there's other people in there, but you don't know who it is. So I was able to hide away in there, and I think the photography tutor sort of got wind of me being in the dark room all the time and just said to me, if you're going to hang out down here, then you've got to join the course. And he said, there's a we're going to put you in for the GCSE photography. And he said, it's in 2 months' time or whatever. You've got to do all this coursework and stuff. So he lent me a camera and I just started taking photos and printing photos, and absolutely loved it, and took the GCSE and then got onto the A-level course, and then just spent my whole time voluntarily in the darkroom.
That's great.
Making these prints, and then you know, I much prefer being in the darkroom than taking the photos, in a way. So, and I think I've carried that through into my, you know, I love editing. Don't tell anybody, but I think I love editing more than being on the shoot.
Right.
But yeah, I started making these photographic, to cut a long story short, I started making these photographic stories where I take a series of stills to create a narrative. And the other photography tutor said to me, you're just basically reinventing film by trying to create sort of the feeling of movement and progression through still images. And he lent me a Super 8 camera, and I shot my first roll of Super 8 in 1993 when I was 17. And
excellent.
Yeah, and that was how I got into it. And I've never sort of thought about anything else since, really.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's a great origin story.
Yeah.
I find it interesting you talk about, like, you found this kind of fascination with the process, and you saying you kind of prefer the editing side, and I really get that sense from your filmmaking. Like, your work's been described as very, like, tactile, and you can quite literally see the fingerprints on it. What do you think that is about the process of the making that intrigues you so much?
It's quite a fashionable thing to say now, but I like real objects. I do like tactile things. I like being able to touch what I'm working with. And also it's a good counterpoint to the shoot where my narrative work, I'm dealing with humans and I'm dealing with collaborators either behind the camera or actors, collaborators in front of the camera. And that's, and I find that not difficult, but I find it, I have to be at the top of my game to do that. I don't necessarily have the personality that I want to constantly meet new people and stuff. I heard somebody describe the other day that when they meet new people, they quite often feel like they're on fire. And I have that feeling as well, sort of like, so I'm not an extrovert. I'm not a particularly gregarious person. So because of the order you do things, you know, you write in isolation. Well, I write in isolation, write on my own.
Yeah.
And then at the point where I'm sort of going mad in my own company, I don't have to shoot, where I'm just surrounded by people, say for a month, which is amazing, but by the end of the shoot, I want to then be on my own again. So I suppose there's two different answers. What one is to do with my personality and wanting to be on my own if I've been in company for a long time. So I love the edit, and I love the creativity that's in the edit, and trying to remake the film within the edit. But the real answer to your question is, I think I just like objects. I like real things. You know, I was we shot the very last pickups of the new film last night here in the attic. We just set up a little studio in the attic here, so big close-ups. And Colin Holt, who lights everything for me, has come down. He's from here originally, but he's come down from Kent, where he now lives for a few days. And so he came over and did an extra day on the shoot, just lighting these close-ups. And just before we got started, I was trying to get the version of the film that's online at the moment, that I've sent to the producer. So it's like the secure link online. And I was just wanted to watch it just to match up, just so we could talk about a couple of shots. I just couldn't get it to play. You know, I couldn't get the sound to come out, and then it got the spinning ball thing, and then the internet connection wasn't enough. And I was just like absolutely fuming inside. But, you know, it seems like it's a crazy thing to say, because you've got a computer that, you know, you could do anything with in your hand. And then you're moaning because it's not quite working how it should be. But it's sort of like that frustration of, like, where is this film? Where is this fucking thing? You know, out there in ether somewhere. And then Colin just sort of spoke my thoughts and just went, just get a disc. Get it on a disc, you know. If it, get it, is it on a disc? Put it in a machine, play it, don't connect to the internet, you know, like this. And he was just kind of, you know, and it was kind of nonsense as well, but it was kind of my thoughts. I think that kind of sums it up, is I like the materiality of it. I think the materiality of film and the form of film is so important, and people shy away from talking about it as if you do talk about it, you're somehow you know, like a tech geek or something like that. And it's all about story, and I'm just like, bollocks to the story, you know. film doesn't even do story that well, I don't think. You know, it does other things much better than it does story, you know. Story's done best. Storytelling, sat round a fire, you know. If you want to tell a story, do that. If you're making a film, it's a mechanical art form, and let's not shy away from the fact it's a mechanical art form. Let's talk about cameras, let's talk about lights, let's talk about you know, that kind of thing. And so that's what I'm always been interested in. And again, I've been sort of apologetic in the past for going, oh, I don't want to fetishize the equipment and stuff, but they're kind of other people's words. I'm not fetishizing it. I'm not denying the fact that, you know, film doesn't happen just invisibly. You have a camera, you have all of this stuff, and it matters how you use that stuff, and it matters which stuff you use. None of it's better than anything else, but that stuff does matter. And I think, and for me, my enjoyment comes from using the specific stuff that I use, and the tactility of it, and the imperfections of it.
Yeah. That's so amazing. That's such a refreshing take on that aspect of it, because nowadays, you know, if I ever listen to any interviews through cinematographers or anything like that, it's a lot of the conversation that often comes up is like the technical bits between different cameras and the likeness of one brand over another. And in Bates specifically, you know, you hand developed all of your film. You spent a lot of time doing that, and it's not an easy process. But I find that really fascinating that you kind of brought that up, because that kind of makes so much more sense from that.
Yeah, I mean, I just love hearing people talking about the technology and the form of filmmaking. You know, I could listen to somebody forever talking about how they made a feature film on their iPhone. Now, I've got no interest in making film on an iPhone. I mean, I don't even own a mobile phone, a smartphone or anything like that, so I couldn't even do it. But the passion that somebody has for the technology they're using, like I say, there's no right or wrong. Nothing's better than anything else. It's just appropriate for what you're doing. And that doesn't mean, you know, the most appropriate thing to use can be the most inappropriate thing if you subvert it the right way. But as long as people kind of... sounds like I'm making rules for people, but what I'm interested in is people who are passionate about the form as well as the content, you know. And I love, you know, like the Roger Deakins podcast. I don't know if you heard that one.
I listen to it a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and I love it when he's, you know, and a lot of the time he's very humble, and he plays down his knowledge of technology, you know, and that kind of thing. And I'm not suggesting that he's being disingenuous, but I love it when he gets a cinematographer on and they kind of get really enthusiastic about a particular old light or something, you know, or, you know, his story that he's told a few times about when he was at the NFTS and they were set a lighting exercise and to somebody being lit in a sort of in a theater mirror with the bulbs all around it. And, you know, they got all the lights out and all this kind of stuff. And he said, just let's light it with these bulbs. And that was the kind of, you know, the way to do it. So the tutor came back and said, why don't you just use the bulbs around the thing? Yeah. And he was really passionate about the sort of the simplicity and the form of it. And I know, you know, him included, and I know, you know, I understand why he does it. He says, you know, that the story's the most important thing. But listening to those cinematographers talk is always most exciting when they're talking about how they use the equipment, how they use the form. You know, I don't even like using the word equipment really, because I do think you end up sounding like you're too obsessed with the tech, but it's about the form, you know, and some of that is tactile stuff, and some of that is more sort of ethereal. But I do think there's too much form deniers within film. Yeah, we shouldn't be ashamed to talk about it.
Definitely in terms of conversation, I agree with you. Yeah, around film, like, it's something that, like, we know a lot of fellow young filmmakers and just film fans in general and all this sort of stuff, and it's surprising how little form, however you want to define form, comes up, like in terms of in terms of equipment being used or cameras or however it is your method, your the way you're approaching making the story. You know, the story, I think people sometimes, I'm a story person, I look for story, but you know, I think people can get too bogged down in story. Yeah. And can you know, and story isn't this kind of, isn't just the words on the page, it's in the film itself, and it all comes together, and every piece is kind of vital.
Yeah, and if you do obsess just on the words on the page, then you overlook the possibilities of what film can do, and the thing that film can do when you combine pictures and sound, and you use geographical and temporal dislocation to jump through space and time. I don't mean space up there, but you know, just physical space. You can go from one location to another. You can cross cut. You can use the sound from one scene over another scene. Suddenly, the world, you know, it transcends. It becomes the language of your subconscious rather than the language, rather than a sort of reality. And if you do obsess about, and it sounds dodgy as well, because it sounds like I'm dismissing the role of the writer, which I'm not. But in a film, the script can never be sacred. Because as soon as you turn those words onto a page into a audio visual thing, they're going to change anyway, and you might as well exploit the full potential. And that's got so much to do with form. You know, with a feature film, for example, that might be in development, you might have 2 years of script development. You might have 6 months of discussing a scene. You might have a fortnight where it's back and forward between writer, director, producer, execs, whoever, discussing one line of dialogue. You know, it's been going on for years.
Yeah.
And then when the script's out, you might a 10-minute conversation about how it's going to be shot, you know, 2-minute conversation about the camera that's going to be shot, which will be dictated by finances 9 times out of 10, not aesthetics. It's like, well, why aren't we getting into the form of this? You know, if we're obsessing about the page, why hasn't this just been written as a short story? It'd be a lot fucking easier. You know, why aren't we just getting into, you know, why don't we have 2 years now of
discussing that aspect?
The form. Yeah.
Yeah.
Testing it of, you know, you do get camera tests and edit tests and stuff like that, but quite often it's a problem solving thing to do with like pre-vis if they're special effects and stuff like that. But you know why they're just the culture doesn't seem to allow for that level of consideration into the form that goes into the script. Yeah. And I do agree, you know, 9 times out of 10, if you've got a bad script, you will make a bad film. That's how important the script is. But plenty of people have made quite bad films with really good scripts or not fully exploited the potential of a script. You can watch a bad film, and then see and have a look at the script afterwards and go, wow, this could have been really good actually.
Yeah,
definitely.
Well, speaking of writing, I was watching some of your interviews and you saying that you kind of, it was in your talk with Roger Ebert, God, what's his name? Lighthouse, Robert Eggers. Oh my God, I'm an idiot.
Oh, right, yeah.
And you were talking about how, I can't believe I just forgot his name. That's awful. But you were talking about how you don't leave a lot on the page. You kind of, it's just what it is. You said you have kind of very specific details maybe, but it's not, you have you described it as like people saying, well, the thing you've pitched isn't on the page.
Yeah.
Do you prefer that? Do you like it being quite locked in?
Yeah, and I think it paradoxically, it's kind of less locked in,
right?
By writing less on the page.
Okay.
What I don't like doing is ascribing any kind of emotion to characters within a script. So I'll never write anything that says, you know, she walked into the room wistfully.
Right. What,
you know, how does somebody act? That's like, you know, it's sort of result directing. I want you to walk in wistfully. And actually what you need to do is what I feel I need to do is just allow the actor to establish how they walk into the room. And if they walk in wistfully, or if it seems wistful, then fine. But actually, a lot of the time, I don't know how that actor walked into the room until I've put a shot before that shot and a shot after that shot. Because quite often what precedes and follows a shot determines what that shot is actually doing. Right. So to make those decisions on behalf of the actor in the writing stage, I think is really bad. You know, and going back to what I was saying about writing in isolation, you spend, I mean, with Bait, it was, I think it was 18 years from starting writing it to it being in the cinemas. So wow. Probably 16 years I was on and off writing it, you know, not constantly, but, you know, it, with various script editors, with various producers and various input from here and there, but essentially alone. So every character in that film is a version of me. When it's on the page, can't be anybody else. They're all versions of me. Even if they're based on the character, they're my interpretation of that person.
I wanted to ask you about that. I'm very curious about that as an idea. Like I don't think I often consider that when I'm reading a script or when I'm watching a film. And maybe it's not the same for everyone, but for you in particular, with Bait, for example, you know, some of the characters in Bait, you could maybe argue, are quite
careful.
I'm not sure. Yeah. I just find it interesting. It's you could say it's kind of telling about how you see things, and but then also to consider that, you know, characters who maybe you're not necessarily on side with in Bait, that you don't like, those are also aspects of you. And I find that interesting.
Well, I think, you know, some people say you can't like a film if you don't like any of the characters in the film. And I don't agree with that, because I think as long as you recognise the characters. So if you look at something like Joanna Hogg's Archipelago, there's no characters in that film that I like, really. Even the woman who's cleaning the house in that film, you know, she irritates me because why she put herself in that position. I don't know whether you know the film or not, but it's very well-to-do people going on holiday and a very dysfunctional family. You just want to climb through the screen and just sort of shake everybody because they're sort of repressed British kind of... And I don't like... And I think a lot of people would probably say they don't like any of the characters particularly in it, or, you know... And I know people who dismiss that film because, you know, from my circles, who dismiss that film, go, well, they're just privileged, entitled people, and, you know, don't like any of them. But I recognise them. So to my mind, I can enjoy that film because I recognise those people. So that's one aspect of sort of the way I write characters, is that I don't mind if they're not on the page likable, as long as they're recognizable. And at that stage, when you write the script, they only have to be recognizable to the people who are portraying them, because then those people will then bring those characters to life. So I can write quite two-dimensional characters because they're not people I know. I don't know the ins and outs of those characters, and I might write with quite broad brushstrokes. But then what the actors do is they come in and give them depth. So the examples in Bait, you know, the second home owning couple, so Mary Woodvine, who plays Sandra, I think that character portrayal is the key to the film, because at the point where she decides to leave the money in the tin at the house as a really clumsy attempt at redemption for the family, I think is the key to the film, because
absolutely.
And you know, and I didn't write it like that on the page. The atmosphere of it, the way she portrayed that, wasn't something that I wrote. Now, I think I wrote it in a way that I didn't have any preconceptions about how that would be done, but I didn't know exactly how she was going to do it. The other thing is that Simon Shepherd, who plays Tim, her husband in the film, he said to me, can I have a scene where there's a moment of reflection for him?
Mm.
And just one day, we had three days to shoot all the interiors of their holiday home. And he said, can I just have one scene that's a moment of reflection for his character? And he suggested it. And he said, maybe I could just be sat in the chair in the other room in the house that we hadn't shown at all. It was like the costume room. And we cleared it all out. We blacked the windows out. Colin beautifully lit it with a lamp to be nighttime. And he poured himself a drink that looked like a sort of single malt whiskey in a fancy glass. And he sat in the chair and he just sat there with his glass of whiskey. Now, I had no idea where that shot was going to go. It's not even a scene. It's just a shot, two shots, sure. But it intercut with her, with Sandra going up to the house to drop the money off. And it was amazing when I dropped it into the edit, because I thought, of course, it'll go here. It'll go on that night. So they've had their meal. It's all been unspoken that they're eating this stolen lobster, whether they know, you know, what they're doing and the implications of what they're doing. And then what happens is they both have a moment of reflection, and hers is proactive. She goes and walks up the hill, you know, and luckily when we shot it, the weather was changing, so it was becoming autumn. So by the time she gets up to the estate, you know, it's raining and it's windy, and she goes into the house and she puts the money there, and the harsh reality of existence for people who are living hand to mouth is all there to be seen. And he sits in the chair and drinks his glass of whiskey. He's impotent. He would never walk up the hill, but he has a moment where he sort of considers stuff. And that just came from him. And that, and I'm happily admit that came from him, because I hadn't fleshed out that character enough in the script. And he said, I think, you know, and it wasn't a selfish thing from him saying, I want another shot, or I want my character to be a bit more likable. He just recognized that there needed to be something. And it was just that moment. And also, what was brilliant then is it made that sequence cut together, which wouldn't have cut together, because I had no traveling shots of Sandra walking up to the estate. So we had sort of this cross-cut thing. So, yeah, it's, you know, I write on my own. Like I was saying, every character is a version of me. And then at the point when you go to shoot, you hand those characters over to the actors, and then they give their sort of 50% of the character.
Okay.
If you, and that's really important, and you've got to really, for me, I've got to really capture that moment where those characters stop being 100% me. If I write feelings and stuff, she walks into the room wistfully. She walks up to the estate guiltily, but with a sense of entitlement. You know, how the hell does somebody act that? You know,
yeah,
you just write. I write on the script. She walks up the hill. So there's nothing to work with there. For the actor, for Mary, other than to go, right, well, how am I going to walk up the hill? And then she has to go back to the scene before, the scene after, and try and work out what the state of mind is. And that might be very different to what I'd imagined, but probably it'll be better because she's inhabiting that single character, whereas I'm trying to write different shades for all these different characters, which nobody can ever do. You know, you've got to hand it over to that, to the actor, and make the most, you know, you're paying these people to be in the film. You've got to get your money's worth. You've got to get their input as well as their craft.
Sure.
You know, and it's crazy because people go, oh, you know, they're writing a script. Hold on, this person's supposed to be walking guiltily, and they're not.
Yeah.
Do it again, but it says in the script, do it guiltily. You know.
I've had that with if I've ever worked on very, you know, small roles on sets, like camera trainee roles or anything like that. There seems to be a miss of that. There's a lot of watching eyes on the process of like how the script's interpreted. In some ways, rightfully so, but in ways that you've described, I love that actors often kind of write their own characters when they're allowed the time to do so. When you did Bait, for example, what was the atmosphere like on set, considering that it was considerably smaller than what usually would be for a film of its size? You know, obviously you shot the film yourself, you direct it, wrote it. A lot had to do with it being quite contained. What was that like in comparison?
Well, I don't have a lot to compare it to, really, because that's the way I always work.
Yeah.
I suppose having done that process sort of three times now with Bait, and then Broncos House, which is the short film I did before it in the same way, and then having just shot Ennis Main, which is the new film. I think it's... Because I shoot on film, we don't shoot a lot of footage. Mm. I think the shooting ratio on Bait was 3-1. We had 4.5 hours of rushes for an hour and a half long film. So when the camera's rolling, all the decisions have been made, which then puts all of the pressure on the cast to nail stuff in rehearsals. But a lot of we don't have a lot of rehearsal time, because once we're on location, we need to be working.
Mm.
So then that puts a lot of emphasis on the actors sort of developing those characters ahead of the shoot and during their downtime on the shoot. So I think that then the actors aren't waiting around for anything from me. You know, they'll come on and we'll do a technical block with the camera for movement, and I'll see the performance, and then I'll just, you know, might push them one way or the other, or just allow them to do what they're doing, you know. And to a certain extent, it's like, just say the lines, and I know that they've been cast, because I know that they've got the appropriate craft, and they've got the appropriate emotional energy, for want of a better word. You know, we'll see the thoughts in the eyes. You know, the dialogue's kind of a lot of the time quite a red herring. You know, the truth is always in the eyes, which if we're capturing that, then we've got the film. Because the other thing is, I don't record any dialogue on the set.
Right, so of course.
They can refine how they're saying it later on. So, for example, we had a scene with Ed Rowe, who plays Martin, the main fisherman, who, when he first goes into the second home, when they ask him to move his truck, and he says, you know, he says a line about... it's all the bits... Sorry, I forgot. I haven't seen this film for a long time. He says all the bits about, you know, like... they say, yeah, can you move your truck? And somebody might bump it. And he says, oh, it's pretty old anyway. And, you know, and then he says, oh, I'm going home now anyway, so I will move it. When that was done on location, you know, he that whole scene was done quite cold. As soon as he was in the house, it was quite, all of that dialogue was threatening, you know, quite confrontational. And then it was actually Kate Byers, one of the producers, who said, I think we should lighten the dialogue at the beginning of the scene, so it becomes
subtlety,
room to move, you know. And because we can change the way that he's doing the dialogue. We can't change the scene. You know, he stood in the doorway of their kitchen, big imposing figure. That's enough. If he's then saying the lines with a bit of a smile in his voice, it becomes a bit ambiguous. You're like, hold on, what's the situation here? You know.
Sure.
And then by the end, where they say to him, "You didn't have to sell us this house," and he says, "Didn't we? Or didn't I? Didn't we?" You know, suddenly, as saying that cold is suddenly, whoa. But it's interesting that you can then take the dialogue that's been delivered in a close-up, and you can revoice it in a completely different way that it was voiced within certain constraints.
Sure. I was going to ask.
So, you know, somebody says something with a smile in their voice, but like daggers in their eyes.
Right, okay.
Pretty powerful, you know, and that was discovered by accident, really.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was curious how, like, locked in you are with it when you haven't got the audio and you're doing it. So, like, you have the performance, and, like, there's certain mannerisms that are very subtle, and if you want to change the tone of something, is it quite difficult to... Does it have to be very slight, or are you surprised by how drastic you
really
can change
it? Really easy. It's all in the sound, you know. People have been doing it for 100 years by changing the music over a scene. You know, you can change it by changing
the music. Of course.
So why not do it with a voice? Why not do it with a read?
Interesting. You know,
it's brilliant.
It's very easy to do, but within, you know, you can't do, because stuff has to be remain roughly in sync. You know, you can't slow a lot down and make it really pointed or anything, but you can always cut away to something. I mean, I've just revoiced the whole scene in the new film, which has got Mary and Ed as the two characters in the film who play Sandra and Martin in Bait. They're the two actors in the new one. And I've just rewritten a scene because they're discussing the weather. And in the script, they're talking about a storm. But we, in the end, we couldn't film the storm. You know, we didn't have enough time for the rain, you know, to get the rain machine in and wind and all that kind of stuff. So they're discussing a storm in this film that doesn't exist. And so I've just rewritten the dialogue and used shots of from behind them, or, you know, you never see them speaking, you just see their reactions, or it cuts to an inanimate object. Now, I bet you that will be one of the scenes that people go, oh, amazing use of montage and cross-cut editing. Or yep. But I'm not sort of, you know, I joke about that, but that's what happens, you know. The limitations and the shortcomings force you to do things in the edit that if you had all the options available to you, you'd never be forced to do. So, you know, that the bit in Bait that a lot of people talk about where it cross-cuts between the two arguments in the pub.
Yes.
You know, the bit around the pool table and the bit around the bar.
Yeah.
I never meant to. In the script, you don't see the young people around the pool table. You hear them in the background. But due to a scheduling error, those three actors were called for that day because they had lines in the script. Now, I forgot to say we don't need the actors that day because that's just all going to be done in dialogue in the background and we'll do it in the studio later on. So they were there. So it was like, right, well, let's shoot their stuff. And because we were shooting it, I rewrote the dialogue. So me and Chloe and Joe and Jake, for half an hour before we shot their bit around the pool table, we went down the end of the bar and wrote the scene. And Chloe, you know, it ends with Chloe saying to Joe and, shut up, dickhead, which is, you know, probably one of my favorite lines in the film. She just said, oh, can I say, shut up, dickhead? And said, yeah, let's put it in. And then we shot it. And then that became a visual scene as well as an audio. And then suddenly it's like, oh, they're kind of reacting to each other's questions. They're sort of answering each other's questions and reacting to each other's accusations across this space. But that was never in the script to see them. Wow. But then suddenly in the edits, oh, this is bonkers, because now, you know, it's like this massive mashup. And then that gave me the real, having cut that scene together, that then gave me the impetus to do all the cross-cutting between the mending of the lobster pot and the two meals that go on towards the end of the film, that massive montage there, which I hadn't in the script. I hadn't really thought about how that would cut together, but because I'd done that other one, by chance, I got all this extra material. It then gave me the impetus to do that other one. So so much of it is written in the edit, which I'm not, you know, don't shy away from that. Quite often it's criticism. It's like people say, oh God, you can see that they made this film in the edit because the script wasn't blah, blah, blah. But I just think the writing works.
That's how the film is made.
Well, the writing and the editing, same thing. You know, you're making a film is two bits of writing with a technical exercise in the middle, and the shoot is the technical exercise, and you've got a writing period before the shoot and a writing period after the shoot. And that's not, you know, not every film is made like that, but I think that my favourite films have all been made like that.
I think that's like it kind of emphasises that it's the marriage of all those elements that are really complicated, and the ability to nail that and get it right is what is the passionate part of why you love that. Like, it emphasizes you talking about your love for editing and that.
Because nobody knows why it works.
Yeah, it just it's pure it's problem solving.
Yeah,
and that's such a huge part of it. And yeah, it's not something that you can just predict and write, no matter how much you think about it beforehand.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
I love those kind of just circumstantial moments where it's just there and you find it.
Yeah.
Other thing that I've spoken about a lot is all those carved mastheads in the pub who, you know, that. So the way that I shoot, I've got 100-foot rolls of film, and at the beginning and end of each roll, there's just bits of film that I'm not sure whether are fogged or not. Right. So I always just shoot a sort of whatever's nearby. And because we were shooting in the pub, I was shooting all of those figureheads in the pub. And I've been in that pub loads of times before, and we'd recce the pub, you know, with the film in mind, and we'd been there for a couple of days shooting other stuff. And I never really noticed the the figureheads or paid any attention to them. But I would get to the end of a roll and we were getting through loads of rolls because there's loads of dialogue in the pub. So, you know, the roll only lasts for 2.5 minutes. So we'd shoot for 2.5 minutes. I'd go, right, I've got to change the roll. Just fire off the end of the roll, film one of those figureheads, put another roll in, fire off the beginning of that roll on a different figurehead. And then when I got to the edit, I had this bin of cutaways of all these figureheads. And because of the way I shoot, and I don't shoot coverage, nothing cuts together seamlessly. So I thought, I need some cutaways in the pub. I thought, oh, I'll put one of these figureheads in, and then I'll put another one in, and then another one. And then I started noticing that they all looked like characters in the film.
Mm.
And everybody had a sort of wooden doppelganger. And then there's this, you know, this whole new sort of petrified cast in this scene, and then put a nice low drone on it, and then it suddenly becomes like a horror film. It's really uneasy and horrible. Now that's not in the script. That wasn't even in my head on the shoot. But then I wrote that in the edit, and I don't think that's any less worthwhile than, you know, any less sort of important than writing it in the script. It's just being alive to what's around you, and that starts on the shoot, but then you've also got to, in the edit, chuck the script away at a certain point and go, right, what's the actual footage I've got here, and creating something sort of new. And that's exciting as well, especially if you've been working on a script for 18 years, to then be able to throw that script away as soon as you finish the shoot. It's like, great, this is a new film now. This isn't gonna, you know,
it's interesting.
Not making the film three times.
And Bait changed quite a lot as well, didn't it? From what I understand, like the thematic kind of core of it maybe was always there. But then it go through quite a few iterations before you landed on a kind of final story.
Yeah, it started out as a 300-page long found footage film that included nearly 2 hours of analog video footage of village hall meetings over a year, like parish council meetings.
Wow.
It was a film about, it cross-cut between parish council meetings where people within the community were discussing the future of the village in the upcoming summer and what then happened in the summer. And the key to it was, it was like a video diary. It was about Martin, the main fisherman, making a film about his life for his unborn child and creating a civil war in the village through picking up this camera and starting to investigate where the power lay within the village. And then it got to where it is now, which is a million miles away. But I think in the process of doing a year of talking about this, when the film came out and doing all these Q&As, I began to realize actually not much had changed really. I'd gone from a film that was, form was key to the telling of the story, to a film where form was key to the telling of the story. They were very different forms, but the form was linked to the theme at the heart of it. So yeah, I think the theme stayed intact the whole way through, which I think is a sign that, you know, that there's something there, you know. The other thing I've realized is that I like films with complex themes, complex themes and very simple plots. And the films that I don't get on with are films that are thematically simple or flaky with a very complicated plot, because I'm terrible at following the plot of films.
Absolutely. I hear you. I hear that.
If it's complicated, I'm just lost. I'd much rather watch, I was rewatching Bellatar's Vote Master Harmonies the other night. If you know that film from about 20 years ago, Hungarian film about a whale that comes, a dead whale that comes as part of a circus to a Hungarian rural village. And the film's 2.5 hours long, and that's basically the plot. But the theme at the heart of it is that it is so beautiful. You know, it's the kind of film that lifts you out of your chair when you're watching it.
Okay.
They're all kind of like, it seems that you're very attracted to like films that almost feel kind of like documentaries in a way, like that kind of reveal of information. Is it have any like documentaries kind of inspired you on your work, or like what are the kind of things that have inspired or pieces that have inspired your work?
For me, anything that inspires me is anybody who's doing something new with the form, or using the form in. I'm not sure if you can do anything new with it actually, but you can do new things by mixing different ways of working together.
Being open about it.
Yeah. And like, I think, you know, my big heroes are, I mean, the thing that, talking to big heroes, Big Hero 6, which I watched the other night, we watch a lot in this house, which is a great film, which is, have you seen it?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Brilliant film. And what I love about that film is it references Stand By Me. It's the brother who died.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so Morgan, who's my stepson, who's 13, we ended up watching Stand By Me through watching Big Hero 6 for a 13-year-old. I think for a 13-year-old, watching Stand By Me is a real rite of passage.
Yeah, definitely.
but, you know, films like that, I mean, that they're the films that inspired me to start with was things like, I mean, Stand By Me really changed my world when I saw that film.
Yeah.
And before that, I'd watched things like, Back to the Future and, I mean, it's sort of around the same time when it, and Ghostbusters and things like that. And then one day I watched a film called The Garden by Derek Jarman, which is a sort of an art film, basically shot on Dungeness in Kent. And that was the first time I watched a film, and it was just on Channel 4, and I saw them trailing it, went into the adverts and said, and we've got a film shot on Super 8 by Derek Jarman in his garden at Dungeness, and like all of that just sounded fascinating, like what the hell's a Dungeness, you know. I was thinking of like Loch Ness and monsters and things, and Super 8 was exciting, so I thought that's a camera that, you know, I've heard of Super 8 cameras, and,
yeah,
and there's the film being made, and he shot it all in his garden, which is difficult to imagine it now because everybody's shooting everything all the time, but back then in the early 90s, this idea that Channel 4 was showing a film that somebody shot in his garden, but then, you know, the reality of what Dungeness is, you know, the massive shingle desert, I think the only desert in Europe, in Kent, and this bonkers art film, and it was the first time I'd seen a film where I thought, there's somebody behind the camera making this film. Whereas everything I'd seen before up until that point, Hollywood films, right, I never thought, I wonder who the director is, you know.
Yeah.
No, yeah. I wonder if, you know, sometimes you go, oh, I've just seen the reflection of the cameraman in the phone box window there or something like that, and you go, well, the form's slightly broken. And like Derek Jarman's film starts with a guy with a Super 8 camera filming somebody else with a Super 8 camera filming an actor getting acting in front of all the arc lights on a set, and it was like, wow, it's just blown the whole mystery of film apart, right, in the first 10 seconds. And actually I'm excited by it, and I'm not disappointed that the fantasy and the artifice has been exposed. I was excited. That's by that. And I think I've carried on trying to expose like in a kind of crusade, but to play with the artifice of film and go, actually, you're watching a film at the moment, and, you know, and that kind of stuff. So, and from there, I really just got into trying to watch as much as I could that other people weren't watching. And part of that is a contrary personality where, you know, if somebody said, oh, I've seen this amazing film, I just automatically, no, that sounds shit. Now, I've seen this film, it was on Channel 4 at 2:40 in the morning, and it was like, it's in Poland and it's about a tree and there's no dialogue or something, you know,
right, yeah,
quite willfully trying to watch bleak stuff.
Yeah.
But I think all of the directors I really like, I think they're, my work isn't like, it doesn't try to be like any of their work, but I'll borrow a bit from all of them. So yeah. I love, one of the obvious influences on my work and the way I cut is Nick Rogue and the editors that he worked with and his use of the camera. I could just watch certainly, you know, that the early Nick Rogue stuff a lot. Bresson is a big hero to me, you know, just the purity, the simplicity. I love the sort of the little mantra that Scorsese has when he gets stuck and he can't think how to do something. He'd always say, what would Bresson do? And Bresson would do the simplest thing. He would find one camera angle and he would shoot it, you know, and he would have one lens. And he wouldn't overcomplicate things. And then also like Tarkovsky.
Yes. Yeah.
Just, but in everything he sort of writes about film, I kind of don't agree with. But
sure, yeah,
you know, because he doesn't believe, never really believe in the power of editing, and the editing doesn't change anything. And because of the way he shot it, it didn't. But I think, you know, there's nobody who creates sort of cinematic atmosphere like him. If ever you want to see where like my editing sort of inspiration is, and there's a film by Agnès Varda, Daguerreotypes, which is a documentary just about the street she lived on in Paris. And it's just like a day in the life or a week in the life of this street. But the film is made in the edit in the best possible way. And this association editing and the match editing and stuff is just, it's just a masterclass.
Brilliant.
And then and these, what's been amazing in the last sort of 2 years is these people I've got to know and become friends with, but people like Andrew Cotting, who I mentioned before, you know, just absolutely essential filmmaker, and just every one of his films is just incredible, you know, the spirit and the willingness to experiment and to push the form, you know, I think we owe him, I certainly owe him a lot. And Peter Strickland as well, just another director. I just think he just goes out and just really pushes the form and tries to do new things, you know, and I really like the one-offs.
Yeah,
because you know the other thing is it's also new film. You know, it's 125 years old.
True.
And as wrote a thing in for Empire, not Empire, Sight and Sound this month, is like, you know, we've got to be taking risks with the language still, and it's everybody's responsibility. You know, the filmmakers have got to be risking failure. The funders have got to be prepared to fail. The exhibitors have got to be prepared to fail. The audiences have got to be prepared to be disappointed, you know?
Yeah.
And that's easier said than done, because it's
true.
It's expensive for everybody, but
yeah,
we shouldn't be playing it safe, you know? And hopefully with what's happened to cinemas in the last 18 months, it might be that we realise what cinema is, you know, where its unique position is and what its role is.
No. Yeah.
Definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Having it not be there in the same way and now going back to it. It's
and it wasn't replaced by sitting at home watching.
No, not watching at all. Stuff. Not at all.
Irrespective of the content and the quality, you know, that stuff may have been high quality, but it was different.
Atmosphere.
Not worse or not better. Mm. It was different. And what it didn't transplant into something else. We hopefully temporarily lost something really important. And now we've got the chance to get it back, hopefully. But it's complicated because, like I say, there's money at stake. And then that's never great when, you know, that Tarkovsky says the only art form entirely dictated by market forces, which I think is less the case now. But, you know, so it's not
still a huge factor about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not cheap to do anything. I mean, we just like, you know, the way. Yeah, I had it on a name drop now. There's Iranian director Hussein Makhmalbaf, who I met in a festival in Finland. And we drove around in a car together for a bit, going to various things at this festival up in Lapland. And he just like spoke wisdom the whole time. And I remember him just saying to me, we were driving along and he looked out the window and he looked at a tree and he said, a tree just is. It doesn't realise it's a tree. It doesn't think about being a tree. And he was looking at his tree and he turned around to me and he said, Mark, be a tree. And it was like, one of those things you go, 3 months later, I just go, I know exactly what you're saying. And he also said, you know, he said to me, he said, filmmaking filmmaking can never be a job. And I thought, and I remember thinking about that, it shouldn't be, it's about, you know, it's a compulsion and it's a passion. It should never be a job. And I spoke to him about it and he said, no, he said, I meant you'll never make any money out of it. So I'm like, okay. You've been literal.
That's amazing.
And we're running out of time with you. So we'll wrap up. But is there, I'm curious about your next feature, of course.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Just how is it going? Is it going all right?
What can you tell us
about it?
It's going all right. When I was editing Bait, I had this feeling that I was just like chipping away at this massive piece of stone. Day after day, I'd go into the studio and just chip away at it. And some days I'd think, it was beginning to take shape. And other days I'd think, no, it just looks like a big fucking stone. And then other days I'd think I've taken too much off it. And I didn't ever think I'd have that experience again, because Bait, for me, I know people say the thing about Bait is it's got such little dialogue in, but for me, it's got a lot of dialogue in it. It's got a lot of characters in it. It pushes and pulls in lots of different ways. This new film is in a lot of ways, is a lot simpler. It's about a woman who's living alone on an island off the coast of Cornwall in 1973. And Ed Rowe is in it. He's a character who visits the island, but, you know, got two scenes maybe, and the rest of it is just this character alone on the island. And so I thought it'd be a much more straightforward edit. But it's exactly the same. It just feels like chipping away at this piece of marble. And it goes back to this piece of stone. It goes back to what we were talking about before. I think it's the unknowns within it. It's what happens when you put two shots together. So on the shoot, you might think, oh, I've got, you're getting all these amazing shots. And, you know, it's like you do a scene and you shout cut and everybody high fives each other and go, oh, that was brilliant. And then in the back of my head, I'm going, yeah, but is it going to cut together? Or I'm thinking, it is going to cut together, but what's it going to be like when the sound's on it? You know, thinking, we're not making the film here. We're creating the building blocks to make the film in the edit. And it's not till you're in the edit and going, oh, God, that doesn't work. Or suddenly that works, you know. And I had a thing 2 weeks ago. I showed the edit to some family, and they all knew the script and they knew the story, and we watched it, and I didn't ask for feedback or anything. It was just one of those screenings where just sit in the room and sort of read the atmosphere of the room and sort of cringe at the bits that I know don't work, that when I'm watching it on my own, I can ignore. But now suddenly there's witnesses to these sort of like failures within the film. And it's a great process, because then I just make notes at the end and then I want to get on to the edit and solve these problems. And there's just this one scene, but with one of the moments where there's two characters in the film, which are very few and far between. When we shot it, you know, just thought it was great and the performances were great. And it's got a moment of comedy, very sort of underplayed comedy, and the physicality, choreography's brilliant. And it's lit so beautifully, and the costumes are just really singing with each other. And it's just the best scene. But I just cut it out of the film after that screening, because it's like, that's a scene from a different film. There's like two different characters. Okay. It's the only time I use a specific camera angle. You know, I'm very strict with, I'd use the same angles over and over again in the locations, because I don't want big geography shots. I want sort of to get familiar with a location by repeating compositions within a space. Suddenly it breaks out of it. It's through a window. It's at a funny 45 degree angle and a bit higher up. It's like, what film is that scene out of? Because that scene, that film that scene should be in, is, I'd like to see that film, but it isn't the film I'm making. So that was
interesting.
Really sort of brought it home that you can think you're doing one thing on the shoot, but actually when you're in the edit, you go, oh no, that doesn't work. It undermines everything. This slow build between these two characters who are going to meet towards the end of the film. This was the moment where they do meet, and I just played it wrong, you know. Not the actors were absolutely brilliant within the direction I gave them, but I just misjudged it. And, you know, in some ways it's like, it would make an amazing sort of DVD extra or something, but it's so wrong. It's like, I don't think I'd even put it on the DVD, but it has given me an idea for a different film with two different characters. That's how different the characters are.
It happens,
so in answer to your question, I mean, I'm deep into post-production. We did we shot the last of the pickups last night. They went off to the lab. They'll go off to, I think the courier probably picks them up tomorrow morning. We'll have that back next week. By next week, we should have the feedback from the execs at Film 4. We'll kind of know where we are. Should all be finished by the end of November, and hoping for a release late August next year, but a load of festival screenings before that.
Okay.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah,
fingers
crossed. We'd certainly love to catch it as soon as we can. Like, we're so intrigued by you and your process. Just one little question about actually doing the film. Were you conscious of, before you went into it, about were you trying to set yourself different challenges going into this film, like as opposed to the last, or anything that you kind of learned about your process that you wanted to challenge? You know, is it like a different genre, or is it or a different kind of process of writing? You know,
it was written very quickly. It was written in 3 nights. I wrote the original 70-page draft, just handwritten, pencil and paper. Did it in sort of 3 feverish sessions. It's got very little dialogue. It's probably got 10 lines of dialogue in the whole film, which allowed me to write it very quickly. Because it is the dialogue that takes time to write it, you know, even just on a functional level of formatting something, you know, as you're writing, having to write that way. I just basically wrote the shots. So in that way, it couldn't be any more different than Bait, you know, 16 years, 18 years or whatever gestation period for Bait. And this one was very short, but we had a year break where we were getting ready to shoot, and then COVID happened. And so we were put on hold for a year, which was great because I got some development support to write a completely different film. So I just dropped this film for 9 months. And then we got the go ahead to go back into production. I picked it up. We did a rewrite. Had to do rewrites based on the COVID restrictions, locations that we lost, things like that. But it's very similar in terms of the way that I work. You know, it's the same camera, it's the same lens, it's 16mm, it's color this time. It's set in 1973, so we've tried to sort of make it look like a film that was made in 1973, which isn't as hard as you'd think considering the equipment that I work with. and we didn't record any location sound, sort of going back and doing all that. I'm doing the score again myself, which I did on Bait. That's the biggest difference, I think, is that, you know, I did the score on Bait kind of by accident. I just created some drones and dropped them into the film, and then there was no credit for who did the score on Bait, but it became quite popular, and Invader Records in Bristol contacted me and put it out as a record, and it's done really well.
It's a good score. Excellent. It's a rather good score, if I may say.
It's surreal. But and so now, you know, I've kind of signed. You know, Invader want to put out the new one, so I've written the score. I say I've written it. I can't write music, so I've written. You know, I
put the sounds together.
I describe what I'm playing and put arrows pointing to different keys and things. And but what's great is I've spoken to more and more musicians and more people who do film scores, and they've all said the same thing to me. It's like, I can't read music either. You know, it's like so much kind of that synth based and stuff that it's about. You know, so I've made a tape delay machine. So I've got 2 quarter-inch tape machines in my studio, and they run on a loop through them. And I've been trying to create all of these sound loops. And I, at the moment, because I'm not working on the edit, I'm re-recording the score each day. But it's weird because I'm now, when I did the one for Bait, I had no expectations about it. And now I know that there's a possibility that this score, unless it's utter shit, this score will come out as a record.
Yeah,
I was thinking the other day. I was going, this would sound great on the soundtrack album. I said, what on the soundtrack album? No, the soundtrack album is a byproduct of the film, the sound that is in the film. I'm not like Elton John. I'm not playing a record. But I kind of, you know, I've got to think. Hold on, work on the film. You're a filmmaker. if those sounds
that's amazing.
Well, never say, never say never. I mean, you know,
what's that?
Never say never. Like,
yeah, I know. Could be a new path. Vangelis eventually with a massive cape on. So there's a bit of that, and I spent so long with bait going, oh, I don't care about the audience. I never think about the audience. If you start thinking about the audience, you're going to fall into a trap. You're going to have second guessing what people are expecting. And I genuinely felt like that with bait, but it was what I've realized is it was easy then because there was no audience. Nobody was waiting for that film. Nobody knew who I was. I didn't have a film before it. Now I can see what that difficult second album state of mind is like, because I keep thinking, oh, what if this isn't well received? You know, what happens then? Or what if this isn't going to be as authentic and genuine as bait? Maybe has it been written too quick? Have we believed, you know, have I believed my own press? Have I, you know, and you start and you think like that, but then that's just a byproduct of sort of working on my own, I think. And last night was a real tonic, having, you know, there's four of us working on in the attic on these close-ups, you know, my first AD here, who was working as a body double for the scene we were shooting. I had Colin, who lights everything, he was down, and Denzel Monk, the producer, was there. And it was like, Jesus, it's like half the crew's back together. And suddenly you feel that sort of energy of everybody pulling together. And you go, yeah, what we're doing is kind of worthwhile, and everybody seems energized by it. And ultimately the proof will be in the pudding of what the film's like.
That's that's incredibly exciting. Thank you for sharing that with us. It's I'm sure it'd be brilliant. You put so much passion and thought into what you do, and so long as it's good by you. Yeah, absolutely.
Because people do say to me, oh, I can't wait for the, you know, I'll put a picture up on Twitter or something, and I'll get a message saying, oh, I can't wait for the new film. And my instant reaction is just like, oh, go away. It isn't finished. But I've put the picture up, and it's just like somebody being supportive or excited or whatever, but immediately I'm the pressure of it. But you know, it's not really a pressure, it's just you sort of yeah, it's I just want to be able to carry on making films, you know. And at the moment I can make films without having to, I've been able to give up the day job.
Yeah,
and I don't want to go back to the day job yet.
Well,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, we hope not. We hope you don't soon, anytime soon. Yeah, that's awesome. Mark, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. This has been fascinating. You're a very fascinating filmmaker. and yeah, very excited to see what comes next for the future for you. Wish you all the best. Well,
stay in touch. And thanks for inviting me on. I'm sorry it took so long to...
That's absolutely fine.
It is completely our pleasure.
Yeah, don't worry about it at all.
I know, I just started thinking, oh no, I'm that wanker who keeps cancelling 5 minutes to spare. But genuinely, things kept coming out. I was like, and I said to Mary, my partner, earlier, I was like, 8 o'clock, I've got to 4:15.
That's so kind of you.
No, it's thank cool, you. Man. It's just thank you so much for the interest.
No worries, thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure. Take care of yourself.
Right on, you too.
Yeah, take care.
Cheers.
See you.